from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on this morning's forum, more than 40 years since the last American troops left Vietnam, revelations of possible war crimes committed by the U.S. military against civilians continue to emerge. In his new book, Kill Anything That Moves, investigative journalist Nick Turse exposes numerous atrocities committed by American troops. He'll join us in studio for the hour ahead. That's after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's forum program. Nick Turse won the Ridenour Prize for Repertorial Distinction, a Guggenheim Fellowship, and a fellowship to Harvard's Radcliffe Institute for Advanced Study for his investigation of war crimes in Vietnam. He's the author of a book called The Complex, and he's also managing editor of TimeDispatch.com and a fellow at the Nation Institute, and recently published a book called Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. His work has appeared in the San Francisco Chronicle, Los Angeles Times, and The Nation. And he joins us for this morning's second forum hour. Good to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks very much for having me on.
Well, I was shocked, I was saddened, I was sickened by this book. It's a tough book to for those of us who had a stake in the Vietnam War. Mine was as a protester. We had no idea what was going on, what you've unearthed here and what you've revealed. We knew about My Lai, certainly, but My Lai was not the bad apple, the anomalous event. It turns out that many assumed it would be. The massacre at My Lai turned out to be standard operating procedure from your work, commonplace.
Yes. You know, My Lai was atypical in one way. There were a tremendous amount of civilians, more than 500 killed over a period of 4 hours. That was a very high body count for one particular massacre. But really, when you look at the time period that My Lai was committed during, in the aftermath of the 1968 Tet Offensive, it's just one of many massacres during the American and Allied counteroffensive that was going on that spring. And within that context, it's very much the way the war is being fought.
Well, the way the war is being fought, it turns out, particularly from your research, is a lot of homicide of civilians, a lot of mutilation, rape, torture. You know, I don't want to get too graphic here, beatings and carpet bombings and massacres. I mean, everybody knows war is hell. And during the Vietnam War, there were guerrillas who were essentially hitting American troops who were children and women and so forth. But the idea here is, let's just get a body count. Any, quote, gook, because that was the attitude, is worth killing.
That's right. The war was really fought predicated on this idea of body count. And this came down from the Pentagon, which at the time was run by Robert McNamara. Previously, he'd been the head of Ford Motor Company. And he went to the Pentagon and thought he could run a war in a quote, rational manner and run it like a business, a ledger sheet where you'd have debits and credits. And because Vietnam wasn't a war like World War I or World War II, where you had two armies facing off across a defined battlefield, the U.S. wasn't trying to take territory, they looked for a metric to show that they were making progress, that they were winning the war. And the one that they settled upon was the body count, basically that you could kill your way to victory, that you could pile up enough Vietnamese bodies that the Vietnamese would capitulate, that they would see the war as a rational exercise. And once they had more debits than credits on their ledger sheet, they would give up the fight. Of course, this was a complete misreading of Vietnamese history. They'd fought the Chinese for a millennia for their independence. They'd fought the Japanese during World War II, fought the French, who tried to reimpose their colonial rule after World War II.
Who were the reason we got into it in the first place.
Well, the U.S. was bankrolling 80% of that French effort. And then when the French pulled out and the U.S. took over the war, they saw the U.S. as just a continuation of the same anti-colonial struggle, the same nationalist struggle to reunite the country. So the entire premise of the war was based on this faulty idea. And the U.S. kept trying to kill their way to victory. They were never successful at it. But what they did in the process was kill tremendous numbers of civilians.
Well, of course, Fog of War was supposed to expose, that was with McNamara front and center, was supposed to expose some of the hideous nature of this Vietnam War and stupidity of it, and it was a kind of culpability. I even got some culpability from Robert McNamara when I had him on way back in the day, but the truth of the matter is a lot of the stuff that you expose is really new. I mean, we're talking about slaughter as an official policy.
Yes, you know, I try in Kill Anything That Moves to show that this isn't the work of rogue troops or bad apples. These aren't isolated incidents. The tremendous amount of killing and wounding of Vietnamese civilians stemmed from command policies that were dictated at the Pentagon and in the top command of the U.S. military in Vietnam. And, you know, I try and show with a paper trail that this is why the killing went on, that it's not just troops in the field. You can't take away individual culpability, but certainly it was command policy that drove this and command policy that killed tremendous numbers of civilians.
And there are so many stories that you get from documents and from repertorial work that you've done here in research as well as interviews. In fact, in reading your book, I remembered a story that was told to me by a fellow broadcaster who was in Vietnam who will remain unnamed. He's deceased now, but he was talking about being up in a helicopter and they were interrogating a civilian. They thought maybe he was a VC and he didn't know anything, and they just threw him out of the helicopter. I mean, you know, I remember being shocked by that story, but the sort of thing you become almost inured to as you go through, the fog of war, as you manage to remove it from our sight, so to speak. I mean, let's talk, for example, about the man who's known as the Butcher of the Delta. I mean, he was called that not only by Americans, fellow Americans, but by Vietnamese. And we're talking about Major General Julian Ewell, the 9th Infantry, and this is known as the Speedy Express in the Mekong Delta.
That's right. Julian Ewell was a World War II hero who had kind of languished at the Pentagon and as a White House attaché for years. And he finally got a combat command in Vietnam, and he decided that he was going to to push his version of war to the hilt. In a military that was obsessed with the idea of body count, Ewell was considered a fanatic. You mentioned that he was called the Butcher of the Delta, and that was by not only the American press, but by his fellow generals. Even when he was interviewed after the war, he said that that his peers classed him in the class of Attila the Hun. So he knew his reputation. And Ewell launched this operation, codenamed Speedy Express, in December of 1968, and it lasted until the end of May 1969. During that operation, he claimed an enemy body count of 11,000 dead, but his troops only had less than 800 weapons to show for it. At the same time, the South Vietnamese forces down in the same area in the Mekong Delta, who were always criticized for a lack of fighting prowess, found exponentially more weapons following their battles. So anyone who cared to look at this disparity between the bodies and the weapons should have been able to see that something was wrong. But the military generally accepted this. Troops in the field knew that their commanders generally didn't care whether or not they had weapons to show for their quote-unquote battles. It was just Vietnamese bodies. And Ewell's operation down there was especially notorious. It was this was uncovered a few years later by reporters from Newsweek magazine who dug into it, who noticed this disparity.
Had a muzzle put on him, basically.
Yeah, their own editors in New York, they really threw up roadblocks to this. Eventually, Newsweek published a very truncated version of the story, but they never got all the information out there. I mean, this was the stuff of Pulitzer Prizes and congressional investigations, but it was cut down to almost nothing. Ewell's name didn't even appear in the article, and
wound up getting a third star as a general and at the Paris Peace Talks. Right, he got a seat at the Paris Peace Talks.
That's right. He was promoted because of Speedy Express. The military did look into this afterwards, and they found out that Newsweek's estimate of 5,000 civilians killed was basically an undercount. The military's own estimates were that up to 7,000 Vietnamese civilians were killed during this operation.
These are the things that really make up war crime trials. I mean, what we're talking about here, and certainly would have been almost perfectly pertinent or fashionable, almost appropriate is really the word I was searching for war crime trials, and yet The media really kind of failed here, and yet whistleblowers were intimidated. I mean, you write about the punishment of rank-and-file soldiers. It was very difficult to tell these stories.
That's right. I should mention that I began this work by finding a collection of documents in the National Archives called the Vietnam War Crimes Working Group Files. And these records, there were hundreds of investigations of massacres, murder, rape, torture, assault, mutilation. And they were generally all the reports came from American troops, either those who were still in the field or recently returned veterans. And, many of them tried to come forward in Vietnam, but they were stifled in various ways, threatened. And even when they came home, they were facing a great amount of pushback from the military. They were often smeared as fake veterans or liars, and it was very difficult for them to get the word out on this. And generally, the military did not take action against individuals.
I mean, investigations were conducted and reports were filed, but they were almost all suppressed and concealed from the public. You
know? That's right. That's right.
And you found in the National Archives that concerned sergeant letter. Let's talk about that, because this was an anonymous letter that was placed by someone who wanted to place it. It actually went to Ron Dellums, former congressman here in the East Bay. Never got out.
That's right. He had witnessed Speedy Express firsthand. And he wrote to General William Westmoreland, who had been the supreme U.S. commander in Vietnam and then had since been promoted up to Army Chief of Staff. And he wrote a very impassioned letter. He laid bare everything that had gone on in the Mekong Delta during Speedy Express. And Westmoreland ignored his letter. He wrote several more to other top generals to try and get someone to investigate. He said that he didn't want to take these allegations to Dellums or the New York Times because he believed in the Army, and he thought that that the military could take action against the individuals involved, and he didn't want to expose the military to scandal. But they never would take action. They did commission a couple studies that were done in-house that showed that there was a lot of credence to what this concerned sergeant had said, but they refused to take action. They eventually did identify him and made plans to make contact with him. I don't know what if they did and if they did what they said, but because he passed away before I could track him down. But he did clam up eventually, and his allegations never came out. The Newsweek reporters never found out about it, and the military claimed that they never had any idea that what had gone on during Speedy Express. They played dumb when Newsweek came to them, when in reality they had someone on the inside who had told them exactly what he had seen.
Talking with Nick Turris, investigative journalist and historian, author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam, and he'll be appearing tonight, 7:30, at the First Congregational Church in Berkeley at an event that's sponsored by KPFA Radio. And Nick Turris's book has received an enormous amount of praise from many of the people who one identifies with the protest in Vietnam and a lot of the research and investigation that went on during the actual time of Vietnam. Jonathan Schell, Cy Hirsch, who exposed Me Lie, and Francis Fitzgerald, Dan Ellsberg, Amy Goodman, Bill Moyers. I mean, it's quite a stunning list of people. Chris Hedges and Andrew Basevich, you know, who I suppose it's fair to say has been a major spokesman even in our contemporary world now against war, because he had experience in Afghanistan, he had experience in Iraq. And there's been a lot of comparisons of your work. Now, I know this may be outside of your purview, but Cy Hirsch, for example, said the lessons still haven't been learned, you know, and others have said that about your book. And the implication is that a lot of what you exposers went on in Afghanistan went on in Iraq, too.
Well, it's I think there are differences in the way that these current wars have been fought. Artillery and air power are used in different ways. There isn't to my knowledge, the same application of heavy firepower on civilian areas in the same way. But it's very tough to get a read on civilian casualties in these current wars. I spent a good deal of time trying to get an embed in Afghanistan to see the military's own what they call the CIVCAS system, their civilian casualty tracking cell, civilian casualty mitigation team. They've set up these structures that are supposed to help to eliminate civilian casualties. The military has their own figures on this, but they won't release them to the public, and they wouldn't release them to me or to other reporters who've tried. So I'm afraid that it might be, you know, 40 years until a journalist or reporter is able to dig into the full story and give us some idea of exactly what these wars have meant for civilians. We know it's been bad, but I don't think we have a clear idea just how bad.
Well, I mentioned all the praise and all the laudatory things that have been said by, you know, a substantial number of substantial people about your book. I want to read and get your response to a review from the Vietnam Veterans of American website by Mark Leibson, who says, Terse is to be commended for compiling a detailed, well-documented account of atrocities committed by American troops against civilians in the Vietnam War. But, and this is a big but, Terse has failed dismally by neglecting to provide the right amount of context for his single-minded version of what he calls the real American war in Vietnam. Terse's main misstep is that he only cursorily mentions the tactics of the other side, tactics that unequivocally contributed to untold numbers of civilian casualties in the Vietnam War. Secondly, in his zeal to paint all of us who served in Vietnam as complicit in what he depicts as an unending string of civilian atrocities, Terse all but ignores the positive accomplishments of the 2.8 million Americans who served in Vietnam. Do not turn to this book if you want to read about U.S. military medical teams visiting rural villages, for example, or Army or Marine programs that work to bring sanitary conditions to remote areas of the country, or American nurses, medics, and doctors treating Vietnamese civilians and even enemy POWs in evacuation hospitals all over South Vietnam, or countless acts of selfless courage under fire by American soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines. Nick Terse.
Well, you know, I have to say that, you know, first off, my book isn't about a lot of those things. There are 30,000 books on the Vietnam War. Many of them do paint a fairly rosy picture of the war. They do tell about American heroism, about the MedCap teams that he talks about Americans who did try and help Vietnamese civilians. I try to take pains in the book to explain that this, what I'm talking about in the war, is not the experience of all American troops who served in Vietnam. This did not go on in all units, but it was systematic and pervasive. You know, Mark mentions, you know, the atrocities on the other side, and this is something that that I don't shy away from. Again, it's not the focus of my book. Other people have written about it, but I'd have to say that if you look at the record of publications in the last 20, 30 years, I doubt there's one other book out there that cites as many war crimes, atrocities by the Vietnamese Revolutionary Forces as my book does. You know, I have about a page and a half of citations in this book for anyone who wants to find out how the other side conducted the war. So a lot of it is in the book, albeit in the notes. You know, and I think it's a worthwhile subject, something that should be looked into.
But there's a very telling story, though. I mean, you tell a lot of stories. You actually talked to a lot of soldiers, interviewed a lot of soldiers in Vietnam. There's this one story about that the soldier tells of, and he's somewhat rueful about it. He hears some chattering behind him by a Vietnamese woman and actually takes the butt of his rifle and just shoves it into her face, into her nose, and the nose is gushing blood and so forth. And he's laughing about this geyser of blood at the time, and then he looks back on it from the distance of being removed from the war and can't believe his actions. I mean, one would say, this is war. War is hell. I mean, people don't behave under normal circumstances.
Yeah, I talked to, you know, hundreds of veterans while I was preparing this book, and the story you just mentioned is one that always sticks out in my mind because it was a marathon phone call with that gentleman, 4 to 5 hours where we talked, and you know, he had you know, a great booming laugh, very jovial. He said that some of you know, the fondest memories of his life were in Vietnam because the relationships with his fellow unit members were so strong. But he told me about this one incident where he broke this woman's nose. He said that he thought he'd probably done worse in Vietnam, but he blocked a lot of that out. But this was, you know, his memory of the war, and you know, it was one that had troubled him for decades after. And I talked to so many veterans who, you know, as 18, 19, 20-year-old boys had committed these horrendous acts, and they'd been paying the price all these decades later. You know, something that that they had a tough time, you know, figuring out how they'd done this as their younger selves, and they had a tough time living with it all these years later.
Talk, again, we're talking to Nick Terse about his book, Kill Anything That Moves. Can you talk a little bit about the Free Fire Zone? Because bringing this up to date, it's still going on in Pakistan. It went on in Vietnam. It goes on in Pakistan under the President Obama administration, as it did under the previous Bush administration.
The idea of free fire zones, it's sort of a legal fiction that the U.S. created in order to justify its actions in Vietnam. Basically, it would declare a large swath of the countryside to be an enemy area. They would fly overhead with aircraft and make announcements to tell civilians in the area to get out or drop leaflets down on the civilians. These were generally illiterate peasants. So, whether or not they can read the leaflets, the U.S. really didn't care about that. They figured that they had done their due diligence at that point, and then they opened the areas up to unrestrained bombardment from bombs, artillery shelling, helicopter gunships. Troops on the ground were given orders that amounted to basically the idea that you could kill anything that moves, that anyone in that area was fair game. They must be an enemy because they didn't leave.
Of course, and they're a mere gook rule. In fact, they talked about the mere gook rule here, didn't they?
Yeah. I shudder when I use that.
It's a horrible word. Yeah, so do I.
But this was the shorthand in Vietnam, that the Vietnamese weren't real people. They were subhuman, mere gooks who could be abused or even killed at will. And I talked to many veterans who told me that as soon as they got to boot camp, to their basic training, they were told that you never called them Vietnamese. You call them gooks or dinks, slants, slopes, rice eaters, anything to take away their humanity, anything that would make it easier to kill them. And I talked to a lot of minority veterans who told me that they recognized right away that these slurs were the same types of things that they were subjected to at home, and they vowed to themselves that they would never use them. But they said that, you just heard it day after day. Everybody used it, basic training, advanced infantry training. When they got to Vietnam, and they found themselves just falling into the use of that word, and it made it much easier for them to see the Vietnamese as something less than human and made it easier to kill.
We're talking again with Nick Turse, and he'll be appearing at the First Congregational Church this evening at 7:30, an event sponsored by KPFA Radio. And you can join us in this conversation. In fact, we welcome your involvement in it, and let me tell you how you can join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. Our toll-free number is available to you, and we do welcome your calls. That number is 866-733-6786, so feel free to call us now and join the program. Again, toll-free 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also, of course, tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. Shed some light maybe on, I mean, this goes all the way, as you've intimated, up to Westmoreland and command in terms of the policies we're talking about here. But My Lai, which by no means was anomalous, as we've determined, as you've determined, I used to scratch my head over the fact that Lieutenant Kelly, I mean, who was really the one who did most of the time and got most of the blame and everything, had not only a commander over him, Captain Medina, who was never brought to justice.
That's right.
But it all kind of fell on Kelly. It was this almost a kind of, I mean, Kelly did some horrible and atrocious, unconscionable things. But again, higher command was just blocked here. It was like almost an obstacle even getting to those higher commands.
That's right. It was very clear that the military settled upon the lowest ranking officer who could shoulder the blame for this. Now, Kelly, as you mentioned, had no shortage of blood on his hands. But there were 500 Vietnamese who were killed there that day. Certainly not the work of one man, many other troops on the ground. There were officers flying overhead in helicopters who saw this. When the investigation happened, there were 228 charges that could have been preferred against ground troops all the way up to generals, but no action was taken.
We'll hear from you when we return on Forum with Nick Turse. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking to historian and investigative journalist Nick Turse, who actually began the research for his book when he was a graduate student and has gone on really to write a very important book called Kill Anything That Moves, A Real American War in Vietnam. And a lot of this came out of certainly Pentagon archives and extensive interviews as well, but it's yeoman work. And more than 40 years since the last American troops left Vietnam, these revelations of possible war crimes committed by the U.S. military against civilians do continue to emerge, and Kill Anything That Moves exposes numerous atrocities that were committed by American troops. One of the real questions, of course, that we are asking subtextually underneath this conversation is 30 years from now, will certain books of this variety perhaps come out about Iraq or Afghanistan? But we'll go to your calls and emails. Again, you can join us toll-free. The number is 866-733-6786 or the email address forum@kqed.org. Or go to our website and join us that way, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And let me remind you, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. Let's go to our callers first. And Anthony from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, good morning.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
I just got to say quickly, I've been listening to your show for 15 years, and you're the best talk show host that NPR has. My question is this, that recently, or first let's start with an observation, that the Prime Minister of Japan recently went to a war memorial for Japanese soldiers from World War II. And both the Obama administration and the Chinese government condemned him for doing so. I'm sure that the President of the United States, right, ever since the 80s when a Vietnam War memorial was built in Washington, goes to that memorial all the time, particularly on Memorial Day. And nowhere do we get anything like the same reaction from governments around the world or from world leaders or from the Vietnamese, for instance. And I mean, just look at the figures, right? Something over 2 million Vietnamese killed in the American phase of the war versus a little less than 59,000 Americans. And like the Japanese, right, the Japanese lost World War II, the United States lost the Vietnam War, but the way that it is remembered, there seems to be an erasure of exactly what what your guest is talking about today. I teach American history, I have an interest in the Vietnam War, and I'm sort of familiar with, you know, explanations that have to do with, you know, America doesn't look like the Americans don't like to see themselves as the members of an empire or as having an empire, and don't think of themselves as being capable of committing war atrocities. I mean, those are some answers, I suppose, to the question that I'm asking. But I wonder if your guest has any further thoughts on that issue.
Well, let's go to you, Nick Terse.
Well, you know, it's you brought up a lot of interesting points there. You know, I don't think that Americans, you know, generally, you know, see their country as an aggressor. The way that the war has been portrayed in this country, I think I mentioned earlier, we have 30,000 books on the war, but it's the civilian side of the war, the Vietnamese civilian suffering, has been left out of that equation. So I don't think Americans have a good idea of what this war meant to the people overseas, and because of that, you know, they don't equate the war with that. You know, there's been since the 1980s sort of a rehabilitation of the Vietnam veteran. I think both political ideologies in this country have come together to celebrate veterans, see them as victims and heroes. And, you know, a history like this, it really doesn't fit into that narrative.
Here's a listener named Kermit who says, it is likely that Mr. Terse overstates the incidents of rape and deliberate murder of civilians. Unlike Mr. Terse, who was not there, and your introductory remarks, it was not standard operating practice. This is inaccuracy in terms of the magnitude or frequency of the incidents described. The reviewer did not see one incident such as this, and neither did I, in 15 months all over the country. Anecdotal or investigative reports, which are conflated with the idea of body count to produce descriptions of such behavior as standard practice, are misleading and inaccurate. The only deliberate murder of civilians, of which I know, was a night near the Michelin rubber plantation where we were called out in the middle of the night to a local village where the VC had killed the mayor of the local village and his wife and daughter because they were cooperating as part of the local government of the Republic of Vietnam.
Well, I'm always gratified if I hear from veterans who say that their units didn't participate in anything like this, and I tried to make that clear in the book. I also make clear that, you know, most of the reports that I have in this book come from American veterans, sworn testimony from them given contemporaneously. They're talking about things that they witnessed firsthand or participated in. This is the war as veterans saw it. And I show through the records that this wasn't these weren't isolated incidents. They didn't take place at one particular time, one particular place in Vietnam, but widespread and ubiquitous across the war. And this is from the Army's own files that really demonstrate this.
The War Crimes Working Group really pretty much catalogs this, I mean, and details this. But is it inflated, perhaps, maybe even hyperbolic, to say this was standard operating procedure?
Well, you know, as the first caller mentioned, you know, 2 million Vietnamese civilians were killed during the war. About 5.3 million were wounded, according to the best estimates that we have. 11 million were made refugees, and that's by the U.S. government's own statistics. It's a tremendous amount of suffering, and it's, you know, the U.S. was the major power there, the one with the firepower enough to kill these civilians. The enemy forces certainly did carry out assassinations. They did sometimes burn down villages. These things happened on the other side, but it was most civilians weren't killed in My Lai-style massacres. They were killed by the application of heavy firepower, and that came from the U.S. And to a lesser degree, its allies in South Vietnam.
Here's a listener who asks, how can an investigative writer be credible when he thinks that Robert McNamara's credentials were as the brief president of Ford? There are hundreds of thousands of dead civilians in Germany and Japan who learned different. I don't think you said that that was, I mean, you weren't giving him kudos or at least I didn't take it as such for his work at Ford. You just said that's what he did before. Right?
I was just trying to make mention of this, that he had a business mindset. Of course, he had previous government service. That was during World War II, and he systematized the bombing in Germany and most especially in Japan. You know, he saw war as something that could be rationally conducted. He used his business acumen and computers, early computers, to wage war. And I was just trying to make the point that this is how he fought the war in this industrial fashion.
Here's Jack. Jack, you're on. Good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning, Michael. Just a quick question. I wonder whether your guest has an opinion about Agent Orange and the devastation it's caused with multi-generational birth defects. And isn't it time that we offered massive reparations to the Vietnamese people?
Well, I do think it's high time. The U.S. government has put you know, a little bit of money in recent years into that. But you know, the best estimates that we have, according to census data from the time, is that 4 million Vietnamese were exposed to Agent Orange and other toxic defoliants, and the effects of these chemicals, these toxic chemicals, has rippled through time, and people are still suffering from it today. There's definite need for remediation efforts, but the political will to really put money into this, of course, is always lacking. But there's always hope.
Sometimes strikes me it's amazing they don't hate us more in Vietnam. I mean, today's Vietnam, they seem actually almost to welcome Americans who come there as tourists and who visit.
I was always shocked by this because, I'd go and interview people about the most horrific events imaginable, the worst days of their lives. And often I would ask them about the same event four or five different ways to make sure that I got the story exactly right. And I put these people through a great deal of trauma, but afterwards they would always thank me. It was always exceptionally humbling, and I was always amazed at the lack of any animosity towards me or towards America. They never asked me for I would ask if they had something they wanted to say to the American people. They never asked for reparations. They weren't looking for a handout from the U.S. They would say that they were glad that we were finally living in peace. That was all they ever wanted. And if they ever asked for anything, it was that the U.S. maybe would invest in Vietnam, be a partner to Vietnam, help to build up infrastructure there, roads and electricity, that type of thing. But no animosity, only gratefulness that we weren't still at war.
They hate us a lot more in countries we've never been at war at or never occupied or, well. Ramona writes, my brother served in Vietnam and came back greatly changed, shot up, suffering from what we now call PTSD. I also served in the United States Marine Corps and can tell you the indoctrination of intolerance, hatred, and aggressive bigotry is pervasive and frightening and continues to this day. Marilee from Oakland writes, thank you for having Nick Turse on today. Is it no wonder that so many Vietnam War vets are so messed up psychologically today? Once again, even though it may be one-sided, we Americans should be ashamed of our wars and the actions that so many took and were expected to take by higher-ups. I shudder to think of the ongoing problems we will have as a result of some pretty terrible stuff that has gone on in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think it is shameful that we don't keep collateral damage counts as well. They are all humans who deserve respect and, ultimately, love. Let me bring another caller on here. Mark, that's you. Hi, Mark.
I was wondering if your gentleman there could comment on the context of our activities vis-a-vis other soldiers and other wars in the same century, you know, starting with the 2 million Armenians that were killed by the Turkish during World War One, and you got the 30 million civilians that were starved to death by the Soviet Union right after that, and at the time of the Vietnam War, the 70 million civilians that were starved to death by nearby communist China. And, you know, weighing what the United States was fighting for, which was to protect the people of Vietnam from the type of murdering of civilians, the 30 million civilians that were murdered by the Soviet Union in the early 30s, and it continued on to that time. You know, we talk a lot about the atrocities the United States had done, but we don't talk very much about what's been done by the enemies and the people that we were trying to, we were fighting against. And so I just wonder if you could put it in context of, you know, war is hell. And were these aberrations as opposed to deliberate policy of a government, which is what opponents had often done in their own people, to their own people?
Nick Turk.
Well, certainly the 20th century was horrific for civilians. Beginning with World War II, civilians and since then, civilians have borne the brunt overwhelmingly of wars, and Vietnam fits into this mold. Certainly, there were other tremendous bloodbaths during the 20th century by countries all over the world. And modern industrial warfare does target civilians disproportionately. We see that to this day. So, you know, Vietnam fits into that paradigm. This is a fact of modern warfare. It's not just the United States. This is how modern wars are fought.
And Mark, we thank you for your call, and we'll go right to another call. And that's Johnny. Good morning. You're on.
Good morning. I just wanted to justify the comparison of Japan's invasion of China with the Vietnamese war the Americans fought to try and liberate a country that was being overtaken by communists. Certainly there was a French occupation prior to that, but it gets much more complicated. And the Japanese are still hated tremendously by the Chinese for that, whereas the Americans are seen as people trying to liberate a country. Many Vietnamese live here in this country in parts of San Francisco and southern California and have great appreciation for the American occupation. I detest all war. People are talking about atrocities that get committed in these wars in Vietnam and others. There's always atrocity committed in wars. War is senseless and crazy.
All right. I thank you for those comments and appreciate them, Johnny. Good to hear from you. We'll hear from another listener, and that's Kevin in Novato. Kevin, join us.
Yes, hi. I've kind of turned in a little bit late, and I was just wondering, I grew up in the Vietnam era. I almost had to go over. Luckily, I did not. But I've never, ever got a solid answer as to why the United States is actually over there. I've heard different stories about for the mineral rights, also for the militaristic positioning in the world, but I never got a direct answer, and I was wondering if I could you had some sort of a comment on that.
It's a question that continues to haunt many of us who remember the Vietnam War. Why did we go? Why were there? I mean, the justification officially that kept coming down from our leaders, quote unquote, was communism. We had to stave it off. I mean, there was a domino theory, and the domino theory was really pervasive. The idea that if Vietnam was lost, Cambodia and Thailand would be lost as well, and the China would be even more hegemonic and dominant.
Yeah, the U.S. clung to this idea of monolithic communism that it was, you know, a creeping worldwide menace, misreading that within communist countries, of course, there was a tremendous amount of animosity between them, and that while Vietnam took aid from China, they had a great fear of communist China. For a millennia, they had fought for their independence from China, and they saw China as a looming threat to the North. And shortly after the American war in Vietnam ended, they had to fight a border war with the Chinese. But the U.S. never saw these as competing powers with competing interests. This idea that the domino theory and one communist menace really gripped the American government and let
but
us
as I said
the
earlier, the French kind of helped us get into that involvement. And there were economic interests. I mean, there were mineral rights, and these have been brought up, and it was seen as a strategic place for the military. I mean, there were a lot of reasons, multi-fact.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, the U.S. saw France as a necessary bulwark after World War II. You know, Roosevelt had, I think his idea was that, you know, Vietnam should emerge from colonialism. But after his death and Truman administration took over, they did not want to see a communist-led government leading Vietnam. So they threw their weight behind the French so that the French would support them in Western Europe.
Here's an email from Amanda who writes, I did not even learn about the Vietnam War in high school. Our history teacher simply said we ran out of time. Can the author, that speaks volumes, can the author speak at all to efforts to educate younger generations about the war, whether this omission is a trend that he's noticed?
Well, it was certainly my experience. We get to the end of the year and we never quite got to Vietnam during my grammar school and high school days. So it wasn't until college that I first read my book on the Vietnam War. I'm sorry to say that I don't know, you know, what the education on this is like across the country. But anecdotally, I've heard that still, you know, history lessons on Vietnam are truncated at best and sometimes still non-existent.
Well, there are all these, as I said, testaments that you've had from people who are saying, boy, I hope that people will, that readers will learn about this and that they'll learn from the lessons of the past and, you know, the old Santayana thing, you know, that's how we historically learn from the past or we repeat our mistakes. And yet, you know, does the public really care about Vietnam? It's 40 years ago. And, you know, those who fought in the war or those who were opposed to the war, yes, still care probably, but there's a whole different generation and they're pretty much removed from it.
Well, I have to say, you know, I've been out on a book tour for a little while now, and I've been heartened to see some young faces in the audience. And I've gone and spoke at some colleges. And I think that, you know, that you know, young people today do see some parallels with the current wars. You know, they've grown up in a state of constant warfare in the United States for more than a decade now. And I think my book has, those who have read it have seen some parallels in the wars today and what was done 40 years ago.
I hope it has that impact, frankly, because there are real lessons in about war in general in your book. And let me get another caller on. It's Kara from Berkeley. Good morning.
Hi.
Kara,
I'm
sorry. Hi.
I just returned from Vietnam, goodness, 2 weeks ago. And, you know, my work is, you know, when I can do it, is working with the children. My graduate degree is in education. And I want to just kind of echo what you've been saying, but also just kind of give you, you know, something from the front lines, because I was in Saigon at they've renamed this museum. Once there was, I guess, there was more friendliness going on between America and Vietnam. It used to be a genocide museum, and now it's the War Memorial Museum in Saigon. I got a huge slap of cold water in the face in terms of, you know, my not knowing about the Vietnam War. I was born at the tail end of it. But the bigger thing that I discovered that was so touching but also heartbreaking is, because of Agent Orange, there is still, I mean, to this day, there are thousands of babies being born with birth defects all over the country. And just the beauty that I saw with these women who are embracing these pains, who may not even live a full life and who have horrific issues that they deal with. Just, it's a country that I noticed the people are extraordinarily resilient and, having been to Rwanda and other places where there's been genocide. But I think for me what was so touching is, you know, these generations, they don't have a choice. It's still happening genetically because of what we did. And, you know, the whole piece around not knowing information about, you know, what's happened, you know, it's true. I knew nothing about the Vietnam War except the very little pieces of it. And I know that we can't all go and visit, but I'm just hoping that more books can come out like the one that you've written, because when you get, you know, young people involved in some way where they are affected and they really do feel a little bit about what happened, I think that more people are on alert that this won't happen again.
All right. Thank you for that report. Appreciate your call. I'll go right to another caller. David, hi. You're on.
Hi. You know, I'm sure that Nick has written a tremendous book that I haven't had a chance to see yet. I'm really glad this radio show is happening. And yet I want to preface this in terms of being someone who was born in 1960, so I've kind of certainly at the tail end of that, and yet my own consciousness, for instance, about the war began somewhere around 69 when my dad was driving down to D.C. from New York to attend the protest. I remember asking him, could I go too? And he said, no, I'm going as a family representative. The consciousness, this book, which is coming out as a revelation, I feel listening to this as a 53-year-old, this is not a revelation to me. I feel like I knew, maybe not every detail. You know, in the 1970s, in the magazine Ramparts, I think it was, which came out of Brooklyn, incredible revelations about...
David, let me jump in here, because, you know, you've probably gotten some of that response, people who said, well, we probably knew about this or knew about a lot of it all along.
Yeah, and I do take pains in the book to show that there was an entire literature on war crimes and the suffering of Vietnamese civilians at the time. But much of that literature has disappeared. It's not cited in the current histories of the war generally. It's become something of a hidden, or you might say a forbidden history.
Well, let me thank David for the call and remind listeners that you're listening to Forum. We're talking with Nick Turris. His book is Kill Anything That Moves. And this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller here. Lorna, that's you. Hi, Lorna.
Good morning, and thank you for your work, as always. My uncle was one of the 11 elite Rangers in World War II that hit Anzio Beach first, and I remembered the stories of him having the post-traumatic stress syndrome, and at that time they had no clue what that was. He died of a heart failure because of these horrible things. But what encourages me now, which is kind of interesting, is that the access to information, and especially books like what Nick is writing, is that I see a change in the way people are looking at war. They are no longer accepting this as a way of life. They are challenging it. They want to hold people accountable. Things of weapons of mass destruction that, you know, you lie to Congress about and then you wind up bankrupting an entire nation over. These things are accountability issues, and perhaps your listeners would like to watch the documentary Why We Fight, that it's really an economic thing any longer. It has nothing to do with moral issues like perhaps World War II might have been, but I think that we're looking at a more compassionate era coming up, and one thing to just clarify about the civilian loss, 50% of all people killed in any war have been civilians, and 95% of those have been women and children. So who are we really at war with?
No, it's good points, Lorna, and I thank you for them. In fact, I'm getting emails that sort of dovetail. I just want to read a couple of them. Here's one listener who says, your hand-wringing over what we call their enemy in Vietnam seems a little hypersensitive and fey to me. I doubt that the terms they used for our soldiers were any more humanizing or culturally sensitive. Dehumanizing your enemy is a precondition of the warrior mindset. Think of the World War II posters where we had even our civilians calling our enemies Japs, Nazis, Krauts, and so forth. And another listener, Ken, along those lines, says, is most of the information in the book from soldier accounts, or from military documents? Does the author have any idea about World War II atrocities? My father was on a Navy sub in the Pacific. He told me about the small fishing boats they would shoot up in the final months of World War II, order to do so, all part of a war, he would say. And there it is again, that sense, war is hell and civilians die, and that's the way that you said the word, paradigm. That's been the paradigm.
Yeah, I have to say, though, that Americans have generally thought of themselves as, and this term is bandied around in all sorts of ways now, but as exceptional, and that Americans don't do this. And I think that it's reflected in a lot of the histories of all of our wars. And, you know, I was really, when I wrote this book, I really wanted to try and bring out, you know, that there's another side to warfare, and that, you know, in our wars, civilians do suffer, even though it's not written in most of the history books.
Robbie, thanks for waiting. You're on with us. Good morning. You're on Forum.
Yes, good morning. First of all, Nick Turris, I've read your book. It's phenomenal, and it changed my life in terms of how I viewed war and America's standing in the world. So I applaud you and thank you for that.
Thank you.
My question relates, well, so I was introduced to the book by a professor of mine. I was a screenwriter at the time studying at NYU, and he told me that it would change my perspective of how these people thought about war and each other. I was curious, in your time spending with people who actually committed these atrocities, what their unifying factor was and their personalities, if there's anything that linked them together, both in who they were before and after these events, and if there seemed to be some sort of camaraderie with them. Because if you read the stories of the survivors that you interviewed, the Vietnamese, there seems to be, as you pointed out, there's no animosity. There's really just, it's a factual thing. It's something that happened to them. And I'm curious if the people you interviewed had the similar take, the Americans, or if they saw it more as something that was forced upon them, or if there was like anything that you felt unified them as people.
Do you see any commonalities of those you talked to?
Well, you know, I don't think there was a certain personality type, anything like that, you know. But the real unifying factor is that all of these were basically American boys at the time, 18, 19, 20 years old. Most of them had, you know, had spent all their time in a very provincial setting, either in an inner city or a small rural town in the South or the Midwest. Very few experiences. They weren't worldly. They were given, you know, extremely poor training for the type of war that they were sent to fight. And they were put in untenable circumstances, led by often officers who weren't much older than they were, who received also, lackluster training, to say the least. So I think that was a big factor of it, that these were young men without a lot of guidance, but with a lot of firepower at their disposal.
Let me thank the caller, and let me thank you, Nick Turse, for the work you've done here, as well as for spending this hour with us. Again, Nick Turse's book is called Kill Anything That Moves, and you can meet him this evening, 7:30. He'll be appearing in Berkeley at the First Congregational Church. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this discussion on our website, going to kqed.org, or go to our Facebook page, and we do welcome, of course, your emails letting us know what you think about what you hear or suggesting further programming. KQED.org is the email address. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor of Forum is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.